I was raised to believe that the Bible defines good and evil for us within its pages. But when we stop and examine this idea using the Bible, we discover something else. In the Garden of Eden, there were two trees, a tree that would bring life to all who ate of its fruit, and a tree that brought death. And it was the second tree, the tree that resulted in death, that contained the knowledge of good and evil. Have we been deceived by the serpent who is trying to get us to eat of the second tree? Is the Bible really trying to define good and evil for us? Let's take a step back. Let's run an experiment. Instead of seeking to define good and evil, let's instead ask the question of the trees. Let's attempt to define life and death, but to do so, we must first seek it out. So join us as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Hey everybody, welcome to the Derech Chai Experiment, the show where we try to better understand the difficult parts of Scripture. In the course of the book of Judges, we are introduced to 12 men who judged Israel. And I know that many will point to Deborah and call her a judge, but she was not the judge in the sense that this book means. Barak was the judge at that time, and Deborah was a prophetess who declared God's judgment. The book of Hebrews backs this idea in chapter 11, but I digress, and I'm only just getting started. Of the 12 judges that are mentioned, 6 are giving nothing more than a handshake greeting. This is Tola, and over here we have Isban, etc. With the other 6 judges, we are told narratives, stories of their exploits and lives. These 6 judges are set apart in the text through a repeat of the pattern that was introduced in chapter 2. Israel did evil. God handed them over to an oppressor. The people cried out for salvation. A judge was appointed. The judge saves Israel. The judge dies. And the people fall into sin, and the cycle begins once again. This is a cycle that I have returned to repeatedly as we've gone through this book, because the cycle is returned to repeatedly in this book. And it is only these 6 judges that contain this cycle, but not all of them contain the cycle perfectly. For example, with Jephthah, when the people called out for deliverance, God declared that he was not going to help. So the people went one step further. They repented and put away their gods. When they did this, God then lent support to their cause, but he did not appoint a judge. Instead, the elders of Gilead appointed Jephthah, a decision that led to Israel's freedom from the Ammonites, but which resulted in warfare between 2 of the tribes of Israel. And God then gave their choice of judge his spirit to assist in the task of freeing Israel. Now, while each of these 6 judges contains this pattern to a great degree, their stories are not all told equally. With Othniel and Ehud, we find the entire pattern, but only a handful of verses describe their situation and the actions that they took to overcome that situation. With Barak and Jephthah, there are 2 chapters that speak at greater length of their exploits, or in the case of Barak, lack of exploits. And in the story of Barak, the 2nd chapter is the recording of an epic war poem that was very common in the ancient Near East when victories were won. The judge, Gideon, has 3 chapters dedicated to his story and 1 chapter for his son. Because of this, Gideon is one of the more fleshed-out characters of the book of Judges, as we get to know the man to some degree. We discover his faith, his courage, his tenacity, his obedience, and in the end, his pride that led to the death of all but 1 of his sons. Then, there is Samson. In the book of Judges, Samson has just as many chapters dedicated to him as Gideon does. 3 chapters that cover several major episodes from the life and exploits of Samson, and 1 chapter speaking of his family. This time, rather than focusing on his children, as the story of Gideon does, this chapter focuses on Samson's parents. This means that we will be spending the next month looking at the life of Samson, and as we do, we're going to find a picture of a very flawed man. He is arrogant, lustful, angry, irresponsible, and bitter, and he has the strength to do something about it, which makes the chapter that we're going to cover today that much more astounding. This man, who we will find out is by no means perfect, is specifically chosen by God to be the deliverer of Israel before his birth. And the way that he is chosen is quite spectacular, and that might lead us to some incorrect conclusions. So let's read the account. Let's dig into just how incredible this beginning is for the man that we know will come from this encounter. Judges chapter 13. And again the children of Israel did evil in the eyes of Adonai, so Adonai gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. And there was a certain man from Sorah, of the clan of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had not born. And an angel of Adonai appeared to the woman and said to her, See now, you are barren and have not born, but you shall conceive, and you shall bear a son. And now please guard, and do not drink wine or strong drink, and do not eat any unclean food. For look, you are conceiving and bearing a son, and let no razor come upon his head, for the youth is a Nazarite from God from the womb on, and he shall begin to save Israel out of the hands of the Philistines. And the woman came and spoke to her husband, saying, A man of Elohim came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God, very awesome. But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not declare to me his name. And he said to me, See, you are conceiving and bearing a son, and now drink no wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean food, for the youth is a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. And Manoah prayed to Adonai and said, O Adonai, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what to do for the youth who is to be born. And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. And the woman ran hurriedly and informed her husband and said to him, See, he has appeared to me, the man who came to me the other day. And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man. And he said to him, Are you the man who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, Now let your words come true. What is to be the rule for the youth's life and his work? And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, Let the woman guard all that I said to her. Let her not eat any food that comes from the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, or eat any unclean food. Let her guard all that which I have commanded her. And Manoah said to the angel of Adonai, Please let us detain you and prepare a young goat for you. And the angel of Adonai said to Manoah, Though you detain me, I do not eat your food. But if you offer an ascending offering, offer it to Adonai. For Manoah did not know he was an angel of Adonai. And Manoah said to the angel of Adonai, What is your name? When your word comes true, we shall honor you. And the angel of Adonai said to him, Why do you ask my name, since it is wondrous? And Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to Adonai. And he did wondrously while Manoah and his wife looked on. And it came to be as the flame went up towards the heavens from the altar, that the angel of Adonai went up in the flame on the altar. And Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell on their faces to the ground. And the angel of Adonai did not appear any more to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was a messenger of Adonai. And Manoah said to his wife, We shall certainly die, because we have seen God. But his wife said to him, If Adonai had been pleased to put us to death, he would not have accepted an ascending offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all this, nor would he have let us hear the like of this. So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and Adonai blessed him. And the spirit of Adonai began to move him at Mahanadan, between Zorah and Eshtael. The angel of the Lord is a deep topic in Scripture. He appears in many ways at various times in history to speak for God, to speak as if he is God. Some say that every mention of the angel of the Lord is a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Yeshua. This view states that the angel of the Lord is Old Testament shorthand for our Messiah. Others will say that the angel of the Lord is simply an angel that's been tasked with delivering a message and speaks for God and can be spoken to as if he were God. Similar to how an ambassador speaks for a nation and when addressed, it's as if addressing the nation that the ambassador represents. Which is it? I'm not sure that I know for a fact. I find both arguments compelling to a degree, but I'm not to a point where I would state emphatically that one view is correct over the other. So why do I even bring this up? We have seen the angel of the Lord twice already in the book of Judges. Once in chapter 2 when the angel of Adonai appeared to the people to tell them that they had failed at taking the land to the extent that God had commanded them. And so the people of the land were going to be a continual thorn in their side from then on. And again in chapter 6 at the beginning of the Gideon narrative, the angel of the Lord appeared to appoint Gideon as the judge for that generation. We've seen this figure twice in this book already, so why am I highlighting him now? Well, because the angel of the Lord appears throughout the Tanakh, but there is only one place in the Tanakh where this figure is mentioned specifically more times than in this chapter, and that is in Numbers 22, when the angel of the Lord stood in the way of Balaam. He stood in the way of an enemy of his people to warn him against going too far. Numbers 22 mentions the angel of the Lord a total of 10 times. This chapter mentions this figure the next highest number of times in a single narrative, and there are 7 specific mentions of the angel of the Lord in this chapter. Now, we should all know by now that when we see a word, idea, or phrase being specifically repeated in the biblical text, the author is trying to direct our attention to something of importance. So when we realize that this chapter contains the 2nd most mentions of the angel of the Lord in a single chapter, and that the subject of this chapter is that the angel of the Lord is handpicking a person to serve him before his birth, it can be easy to assume that this indicates that God is giving a glowing recommendation of the individual that's being chosen. I mean, let's look at other examples of this happening. Genesis 18, the angel of the Lord told Abraham and Sarah that they would have a son, just as in this story, Sarah was barren. Or John the Baptist in Luke 1, again, the mother was barren. And in this case, the Nazirite from birth stipulation is also included. And just like with Isaac, an angel appears as a glowing recommendation of the person who was to come. Or Yeshua, the ultimate example, not a Nazirite or a barren woman, but a virgin, and not specifically the angel of the Lord, but still an angelic visitation to tell of a forthcoming miraculous son. Again, there is implicit in this announcement a glowing recommendation of the one to come. We could even possibly compare this story to the story of Samuel, a barren mother who goes before God and is granted a son. A son that then becomes one of the most influential prophets in the Tanakh. Every other time that we see an angel visit a woman who cannot have a child to tell of that child's coming, the person who results of this miraculous visitation and birth is a righteous person. Someone who does God's will and serves God wholeheartedly. So what's the deal with Samson? Samson seems to be the exception to this pattern that we see repeated throughout Scripture. As I already stated, he is arrogant, he is lustful, he is irresponsible, he is an angry and bitter man who holds grudges and takes vengeance into his own hands, a man so full of hubris that he actually tells a woman who is obviously set against him because he wants to sleep with her. This is not a really righteous man, as are the other men who are foretold of by the angel. And if we continue to look, Samson breaks another pattern. Just as we saw with Jephthah 2 chapters ago, the pattern of judges was broken in this case, when the man appointed him as judge rather than God appointing him. Well, in Samson's case, we see that pattern broken yet again in another way. The people sin. The people are subjected to an oppressive enemy. But the people do not call out for deliverance before God appoints this judge. God appoints Samson to judge without any plea from the people. Samson was not a response to prayerful requests or an impassioned plea. Samson was just appointed from birth and foretold by the angel of the Lord. So Samson should be a great dude, and his family had to be righteous people. But that is not what we read. At the beginning of this chapter, the angel visits Samson's mother. Interestingly enough, we are never told her name, only Manoah's name, and that she was his wife. In fact, every time that she is mentioned, it is the relationship to Samson or Manoah that is used to refer to her. You would think that a woman who had been visited by the angel of the Lord, who had had a child after being thought barren, that we might know her name. After all, we know Sarah, Hannah, Elizabeth, Mary, but we don't know Samson's mother. Added to this, the instructions given by the angel include something that make them interesting. Manoah's wife is told that Samson is to be a Nazirite from birth, and this means that she is not to drink or eat from the vine. So no wine, no grapes, or no balsamic reductions. The Nazirite vow also means that she will never get a lock of his hair to hide away somewhere, but she will also never have to give a squirming child a haircut. But there's another command that is given that is not explicitly connected to the Nazirite vow. Eat no unclean thing. Why would Manoah's wife be told to eat no unclean thing unless she were in the habit of eating unclean things? Is it possible that these Israelites were eating unclean things? So why would God choose this family for his deliverer to come through if they weren't completely righteous? I'm sure there were plenty of Levite families around who ate clean. Why none of them? After all, it's such a simple thing to do. Well, let's come back to that in a moment. So Manoah's wife comes to him and tells him the message, and Manoah responds with faith, but a bit of confusion. That's all he said? Well, let's ask him back to find out more about this child. So he prays and God responds, not by sending an angel to Manoah, but by sending the angel of the Lord to Manoah's wife once again, and doing so while they are not near each other. Manoah's wife has to go and retrieve Manoah to meet with the angel. I can't help but get a mental image of the angel of the Lord standing around all by himself in the middle of a field, waiting for them to return, twiddling his thumbs, tossing pebbles, passing the time until a tired and sweaty couple return to question him. And when Manoah gets there, what does he first ask? "Are you the guy who talked to my wife that first time?" is the first question. But then he begins his next question with, "When these things come true?" Manoah believes what the angel has said. He is just not sure if the instructions that he received were all that he needs to know. And he doesn't actually know that this guy is an angel yet either. Manoah trusts that the stranger is telling the truth. So he asks, "What manner of life is the child supposed to live, and what is his mission?" Manoah wants to set Samson up for success. Is he supposed to go to a private school or a homeschool? Should he wear only corduroy pants or a tie everywhere he goes? And what is he going to do? Should I put him in karate or chess club? What about teaching him music or dance? I want this kid to do the absolute best at what God is appointing him to do, so give me all the details so I can make it happen. And the angel's response? Just do what I've already told you to do. You don't need to make it more complicated or take more upon yourself. Just do what you have been commanded. Manoah seems to accept this, and so in classic ancient Near East fashion, Manoah then offers to host this man for dinner. To do anything else would be to heap shame upon the stranger who had brought good news and was obviously a man of God. But the angel refuses. He says, "If you have a goat to offer, then don't make me a meal. I wouldn't eat it. Instead, make a burnt offering to Adonai." Now this is very interesting, because the Torah makes it very clear that if you are going to make a sacrifice to God, you are to do so in the tabernacle. Deuteronomy 12:5-7 says, "But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all of your tribes to put his name, and to make his habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings, and your sacrifices, your tithes, and the contribution that you present, your vow offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God blessed you." And the offerings that were to be offered were to be officiated by the sons of Aaron. Leviticus 1:10-13. "If his gift for a burnt offering is from the flock, from the sheep or the goats, he shall bring a male without blemish, and he shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord, and Aaron's son, the priest, shall throw its blood against the sides of the altar. And he shall cut it into pieces with its head and its fat, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood that is on the fire on the altar. But the entrails and the legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall offer it, all of it, and burn it on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, with a pleasing aroma to the Lord." Here we have the angel of the Lord suggesting that Manoah himself offer an olah offering in the territory of Dan on a rock. Not just suggesting it, but then accepting the offering and ascending to heaven in the flame of the offering. What are we to make of this? Let me ask you some questions that might stretch you a bit. Is it possible for God to command something that's a sin? Will God accept a thing that is accomplished through sin? How about, is sacrificing outside of the tabernacle a sin? On the surface, it might seem to be, yes, of course. But then the angel of the Lord suggests and accepts a sacrifice outside of the tabernacle, which did stand in Shiloh at this time. How about this question? Is it possible that we simply don't know how to properly read and understand the Torah? Maybe God isn't sitting up there just waiting for us to fail or for others to fail so that he can destroy us in fire and brimstone. Maybe, just maybe, doing our best is all that he wants from us, and he will work with us where we are and accept it. Maybe the Torah isn't a list of do's and don'ts as we conceive of it. Maybe it's as Paul says in Galatians, the Torah is a tutor that's meant to train us in how to live as mature humans in this world that God has given us. Maybe it is as Isaiah 28 says, turning the word of God into a checklist leads to destruction. Isaiah 28:13. And the word of the Lord will be to them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little, that they may go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. Let's face it. This chapter looks us square in the face and dares us to call foul on what happens here. Are you going to be the first one to call out what seems to be a sin or a failure to keep the Torah? Are you prepared to say that the angel of the Lord caused Manoah to sin? You see, this entire book is about pride. We have returned to this topic repeatedly and looked at how it can manifest in various ways, and we have seen it manifest in various judges. But there is one manifestation of pride that is truly insidious, as it can overtake a person without them or anyone else having any idea that it's happening. It is a form of pride that looks good to the outside observer and feels good to the person who is exhibiting it, and that is the pride of self-righteousness. But Aaron, where do you get that from the text? The answer is simple. I got it from reading the text. The only way to reconcile what seems to be a record of the angel of the Lord suggesting that a man sin and then accepting that sin is to recognize that I just don't understand well enough. My mind, which is stuck in the idea of a legal system, can't reconcile this. So rather than the Bible or the angel of the Lord being at fault here, the fault must entirely be on me for wanting to ascribe sin to this interaction. And if knowing the Torah and what it has to say about how to offer sacrifices have this reaction towards the angel of the Lord, and I am wrong in this situation, then how often have I been wrong when I've looked down on others who I perceive to be failing in various ways? How often have I looked down on others because they eat unclean foods? How often have I turned my nose up at those who worship in ways that are not specifically prescribed in Torah? How often do I consider myself better than those who live lives steeped in anger, arrogance, bitterness, irresponsibility, or lust? How often have I concluded that God doesn't love them or can't work through them because of the failures in their lives? How arrogant of me to set myself up as the arbiter of right and wrong in the lives of others! Now, does this mean that the Torah is not applicable or that we should simply discard it? Not at all. The Torah is still God's desired standard for his people, but none of us keep that standard perfectly. And I think that it is finally sinking in that we can't keep the Torah properly because we simply don't understand it well enough to do so. It is prideful and self-righteous of me to imagine that I do understand, that I do know better than God what is in a person's heart. And it is prideful and self-righteous of me to look down on other professing Christians who do not keep the dietary laws or worship in the same way. That is not to say that we drop all judgments. There are egregious sins that we are to correct and judge. But there are other things that we need to do that I need to soften on. And frankly, these lesser things are the things that differentiate us from Christianity in general. And so once again, in the course of the book of Judges, we are faced with our own pride. This time it's not the arrogant and in-your-face pride. It's not the pride of importance and fame. And it's not the pride of false humility. It's the pride of seeing yourself as righteous before God while others who struggle to truly know God are looked down upon. It's the pride that Yeshua points out in Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get." But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted." Let's stop looking down on others who are attempting to know God. Let's stop relying on our works to justify us before God. And let's stop comparing ourselves to others in some game of, "I am better than you are." We can only ever compare ourselves to two individuals. One is God, and in that comparison, we will always fall short. The other is to compare ourselves today with ourselves from yesterday. And when we can learn to do this, we will begin to find life. So Derech Chai, seek life. Shalom.
Thank you for tuning in to Derech Chai. If this content has blessed you and you would like more, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, and sharing with others. To find out more about what we do and to support this ministry, head over to seeklifesc.com. That's seeklifesc.com. We'll see you again next time as we Derech Chai, as we seek life. Shalom.